Now, something that we don't often talk about here, we were talking a few months ago about blood donations and how during the peak of the pandemic, the demand was outweighing the supply. I'm wondering what might have happened during the pandemic in this area where we're talking about egg and sperm donors. There was an article we noticed on The Conversation where they actually went and did a survey of people just to ask them why they don't undertake sperm donations and donating eggs. And some of you listening to this would go, well, no, I wouldn't do it, because there's a significant number of people said exactly that. In Australia, the situation is, unlike places like the United States, you don't get paid. It's a voluntary thing. And that under the law, if a child is produced, once they reach the age of 18, they're entitled to your information about who you are. So let's find out about this. Dr. Peter Illingworth is the medical director at IVF Australia. He joins us now. Doctor, good evening to you.
Good evening, John.
Now, I think I've tried to explain the situation reasonably well there. That's the situation here, isn't it? It's you do it voluntarily, you can't be paid, and there's an entitlement to know who you are at the age of 18 if a child is produced?
That's correct. That's exactly right. That donation is exactly that. It's a gift in this country, and you can't be paid more than normal reimbursement of the expenses that you incur in making the donation.
And there's a reason for that. There's been quite a debate, hasn't there, and a push from people who have tried to find out who their biological parents or parent were, and as a result of that, this law's in place?
That's correct. If 20 years ago or so, people used to recruit sperm donors on the basis of future anonymity. However, many of the children, now young adults, who were conceived through that have experienced a lot of distress and disconnect from not knowing where they've come from. And nowadays, all sperm and egg donation in this country is done on the basis that the identity is always provided to the child conceived from that donation when the child reaches 18.
So that's an interesting exercise then, that change. Did that mean fewer people were prepared to do it, knowing that down the track someone could come knocking on the door?
Initially, it did. Initially, for a while, we struggled to recruit any sperm donors in the early years of that change. But now we see a new generation of potential sperm donors and egg donors coming forward who understand that that is the best way to do this, and who are willing to donate eggs and sperms on the basis that a child could approach them in the future for future contact.
Doesn't work the other way, though, does it? Someone won't have an entitlement 18 years, 20 years down the track to go and find someone who is their son or daughter?
That's correct. It certainly does not work the other way. In fact, protecting the privacy of the families created from donor eggs and donor sperm is one of the key priorities of all of this. Now, however, in practice, many, particularly sperm donors, children will contact the donor, and most of the time the donors will expect a degree of contact with children conceived from their donation.
Yeah. Does the donor, if there is a contact, I guess the donor, it's up to the donor, because the child knows who they are, but the donor doesn't actually have to have any contact with them, do they?
That's correct. But in most cases, when people go through, there's a lot of counselling involved in all of this. And in most cases, people who make a decision to donate are aware that there will be future contact. And if someone is completely averse to future contact, they normally would not donate in the first place.
I mentioned the situation during the pandemic. I presume, like everything else, everything was upended, correct?
That was exactly the same. Yep, exactly the same as you described, that there was a big shortage of donations for a little while. Thankfully, it's come back again since. But there was a while when we were really struggling to get people to donate eggs or sperm.
But is there still a case where you've got more people that need them than those prepared to donate?
I think that's always going to be the case, that there are more people who are seeking to access, particularly donated sperm and donated eggs, than there are people willing to be donors for those things.
Yeah. Of course, if you can actually go and recruit someone you know, a friend, someone, you know, member of your extended family, whatever it might be, you can do it that way, can't you?
You can, and many people do, particularly, for instance, if a young woman discovers that she's got a very low egg number and has to use donated eggs to have her family, and she has a young sister of the same age, then very commonly that sister will help her sister out by giving her eggs. That has a lot of benefits for the family, as long as the family is comfortable with it, because it means that the child is genetically related to the birth mother.
Yeah. So what about the criteria? So someone turns up, do you do health checks? What do you do, both for men and women?
Yeah, so it's the same for men and women. The main priority is ensuring that there's nothing wrong with the health of the donor that could affect the health of either the child being conceived or the woman who is receiving the donation. So we check very carefully for infections. We do a lot of infection testing. Nowadays, we're doing increasingly sophisticated genetic testing. So as well as checking what runs in the family, we also do genetic panels to ensure that there's no genetic matches between the donor and the woman whose eggs are being used that could affect the health of the child.
Yeah. I'm assuming then you've got to look at, well, the age of the women who are seeking your services, and that's been controversial over the years in terms of what the upper age limit would be. And on the other side, for men donating sperm and women donating eggs, I guess there's an age issue there, is there?
There is. There's a biology rather than anything we decide. The biology is that as men get beyond the age of 45, they carry an increasing range of genetic problems that could affect the health of a child. So there's lots of conditions. For example, autism is one. Schizophrenia is another, which are closely related to the age of the father, not the age of the mother. Mm. And the risk of that goes up a lot, very quickly, as a man ages beyond 45. So most clinics who are recruiting sperm donors will not accept donors beyond the age of 45.
But you can't check the sperm can't be checked for any of that, can it? Not now.
No, you can't, because it's just random changes in an individual sperm that become more common as the man's sperm ages.
Yeah.
Remember that women make all their eggs before they're born, and men are making fresh sperm every day of their lives. So by the time a man gets into his 50s, those sperm have gone through an awful lot of divisions to get to that point.
I'm assuming it's a bit more than just sticking it into a freezer, but how long can they be kept there?
Right, the processes for storing eggs and sperm, because these are incredibly valuable things for the people involved, are that they're stored in secure laboratories, tracked digitally with electronic tracking to ensure we know the identity and the location of every egg and sperm sample that we hold. They are stored in liquid nitrogen at minus 200 degrees. That's almost absolute zero, and way lower than putting a steak into your freezer at home.
Yeah.
And in all of that, they can survive almost forever, we think. No one's demonstrated any serious effects of prolonged storage under those conditions. And we see the occasional case of a couple, for example, who've stored an embryo that they made at the time of their IVF, and then they've moved on with their lives, but find themselves 15, 20 years later unable to discard those embryos for ethical reasons, and have come back and had another baby. From an embryo created 15 or 20 years earlier.
Yeah. There's a story today from the United States. I think there's one that's been frozen for nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
Think they're saying that could be a world record. So that enforces what you've just said. And finally, the United States, of course, is where people are paid for sperm donations. And under their rules, of course, the person remains anonymous. Do they get more people willing to do it on the basis that they're getting paid for it?
They do. The combination of the anonymity and the payment means that they have more donors. But what we've learned in this country, and which they will learn in the US as well, is that that has serious effects for the children conceived from those donations.
Yeah, and you do think, I mean, I know from terms of what you do, having more to work with would be terrific, but you do now see that there's this ongoing issue, and the anonymity has created problems which is now being dealt with.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. The anonymity was thought to be a good idea at the time, but in the long run, it doesn't work out for the families.
All right. And so, how many people are doing this on a regular basis? A proportion? Is there a way we can get some sort of overall assessment?
Yeah, look, there are around about, a few hundred women in New South Wales, for instance, each year conceive using donated sperm.
Okay, a few hundred a year. That's just in New South Wales, so we could probably extrapolate that across the country as well.
Yep.
All right. Dr. Rellingworth, most interesting. I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure, John. Thank you.
Yeah, from IVF Australia. Very interesting, as I say, Peter Illingworth. And it is one of those things we probably don't talk about as much, but for those who are involved, and I do think the change to meaning that those who are, of course, children of sperm donors can have that information once they turn 18. I think that's a really worthwhile change that's occurred in recent years.